different people trying this, requesting that the talk, it's the use of tradition. How I can remember when I, as a novice, it's like it's the first, as in terms of monastic training anyway, it's your kind of first intro to public performance, requesting the Dhamma talk. I know I felt extremely self-conscious having to do that. But it is, it's nice, these traditions. They really, you know, when people know how they work, and you know, when people know the chanting, you know, when the bowing comes in and the request and the response and so forth, it flows very nicely. Anyway, here it is. It's Good Friday. Jolly good. And the full moon. One of the Ajahn Buridhamo's asked me to look at some of these questions. I'm kind of running out of time a little bit. One of them was on the full moon. It doesn't have any, as far as I'm aware, it doesn't have any. I mean, there may be astrological elements involved, but at the time of the Buddha, the moon was that's the way the time was told. It's a very, its cycle is much more more easily measured than the sun on a longer term, so you get roughly a monthly cycle with the moon. So we have our, in terms of the monastic tradition, every fortnight, new moon and full moon. So we had a little ceremony this afternoon together to acknowledge that, the full moon. And then depending on how many monks are, that ceremony varies. Anyway, it's having another opportunity to talk, I can pick up on, as predicted, there's a couple of things I missed last night. One of them is a word of warning, a note of caution as regards the present moment, because there are mostly Asian, they have this way of taking basic concepts and cloning them, turning out cheap reproductions. So be warned, this is the authentic present moment. Don't settle for any substitutes. And the other thing was, forgot to mention the gift shop. You see, after the tour of the present moment, you should go out and buy the t-shirt and the mug and the beer mat and the hat and so forth. It supports the running of the place. And where would the present moment be if we didn't have funds enough through the gift shop? But anyway, this is just my view of the world. But it is interesting, through these things, like the gift shop, what's in the gift shop? Cheap clones and imitations of the present moment. You kind of buy, you know, I mean, people come back from holiday with kind of suitcases filled up with memorabilia. Right? Trying to remember, trying to, not to completely, you know, squash the whole thing, but just seeing, trying to capture that present moment. You know, you've been to Graceland, so you've got to buy the plastic Elvis hairpiece or something, you know, to or whatever. In extreme situations, you do see people who are just so kind of lost in that, in recapturing. I mean, perhaps in one instance, young people are so inclined to the future because they have so much of it. Old people have kind of run out of future. So it's all this kind of, you know, pulling out the photograph albums and just, it's all about remembering the good old days and the present moment, because it's often, you know, I'm getting glimpses of old age, and that pleasure-pain principle, it's sometimes reflecting back that the past, memories of the past actually, you know, almost like an escape from the present moment. That line from Leonard Cohen. I forget the name of the song. It goes something like that. And he locked himself in a library shelf with the pictures of their honeymoon. And I've heard from the nurse that he's gotten much worse and his practice is all in ruins. It's this idea of kind of, you know, locking oneself away with the memories or the image of a reality rather than actually being present with, especially when it is, you know, much of life, or certainly bits of life, are not particularly pleasant and are difficult to open up to acknowledge, to accept. But anything really short of that is accepting a substitute, you know, a cheap clone made in China. I shouldn't disparage the Chinese, but they seem to be doing a lot of it. These things. It used to be the Japanese. When I was a kid, these kind of, you know, wind-up toys, they're all after the war. Anyway, that's the sequel, of course. See, it's after the present moment tour, we have the ultimate reality tour, which is basically the same thing, but we just rebrand. We change the logo, change the staff uniforms. It's this idea the thing about ultimate reality, it's a bit like the present moment. I mean, this is it. This is ultimate reality. Welcome. And we do have, you know, that there should be some kind of a fanfare, or that ultimate reality should be bigger, better, brighter. There should be some ambient music and so forth. Ultimate reality, like Nibbana. One of the Zen stories, you know, someone was asking the Zen master, well, you know, what's enlightenment like? And he said, just the same as usual. Just a couple of inches higher off the ground. And so much of social activity, you know, so much of what we do is seeking the extraordinary. That the ordinary is not, well, it's just ordinary, and life is filled with so much of it. And what we really want, or what we're encouraged to seek, is the extraordinary. You know, so many products come. The product in itself is not good enough. It has to be the product with the extra 10%. You know, buy one, get this free, or something. That the thing in itself, we're so conditioned to look for, you know, the experience plus, or product plus, life plus. But ordinary life is somehow unacceptable. It's unsatisfactory. You shouldn't settle for it. You should strive and work harder, get more money, and get a real life. And it's kind of like the memorabilia. It's difficult not to, you know, buy into the extra bit, the upgrade. Ultimate reality. Because so much of our life, you know, in terms of this idea of acceptance, allowance, so much of our life is just ordinary. Just getting up, doing what one does, you know, going here, going there. Eating, breathing in and out. Very ordinary. And then there are peak moments. Life does go through cycles. There are like really good days and there are not so good days. And much of it is just quite ordinary. One of the reflections I use a lot from when especially when things are not how perhaps I would prefer them. Like a little quotable quote, that enlightenment is not necessarily always accompanied by pleasant feeling. That enlightenment is freedom from attachment. It's not getting what you want. It's freedom from that. I think the third Zen patriarch, a really nice verse that I like. It starts off, the great way is not difficult, for those who have no preferences. It goes on in that kind of vein. It's a statement on non-duality in relation to enlightenment. Another line says, do not seek truth. Do not seek for truth. Merely cease to cherish opinions. So if one can let go of good and bad, big and small, because in the present moment, the present moment is non-relative. This is just the way it is. It is a given. It's only when we start to compare it with something that we remember in the past, another room that we were in, or another group of people that we were with, or another retreat that we were on, or another centre, or we speculate about the future, how it could be in relation to memories of the past or our perceptions. In and of itself, in isolation, it's perfect. There's nothing good about it, there's nothing bad about it, there's nothing big about it, there's nothing small about it. Another quote from that same verse, when love and hate are both absent, the way is in perfect harmony. Make the slightest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. So the inference there is that when the way is in harmony, heaven and earth are in union through distinction, through the discriminative mind, making these divisions of beautiful and ugly, big and small, like and dislike, that we set heaven and earth apart. Now, often the presumption that heaven is where Nibbana is, and it's actually it's an integration of the two. It's kind of like the yin and yang symbol, where you get the mixture or the balance of black and white, the kind of non-duality. There's another one of the questions was about a quote from the canon, the chap called Bahia of the bark cloth. There are all these different characters in the suttas from different sects and so forth, and their discourse with the Buddhas. With the Buddha, they usually come with some kind of a question or a challenge. And Bahia had travelled quite some distance and gone to a tremendous effort to meet the Buddha, and he finally caught up with him. The Buddha was on arms round, and he came before the Buddha on the road and paid his respects and hands in Anjali and asked the Buddha for a teaching, and the Buddha said it's not the appropriate time, we're on arms round. And he asked for a second time and do all these things in threes, and asked again for a third time, and the Buddha finally acquiesced. And his question was, where do earth, air, fire and water find no footing? And that's the translation that I know of. And the Buddha's reply, teaching in brief, he says that when in the seen there is just the seen, and in the heard there is just the heard, then Bahia, the earth, air, fire and water find no footing. So it's like in the first instance, putting one's experience or one's whole sense of being in terms of earth, air, fire and water existence. When I can see something just as it is to be seen, because the usual like one of the structures of dependent origination is contact feeling, like sort of contact a sense object. So in terms of seeing, the eye, the organ of the eye, contacts this metal thing on the floor here, and if the eye is in working order, then there's some kind of a feeling through contact, this feeling, which is pleasant, unpleasant or neutral. In relation to that feeling, some form of perception arises. They give it a value. So know, in a basic form, you know, the fight and flight, can I eat it or will it eat me? That kind of a thing. Do I like it? Is it okay? Should I run away? Those kind of perceptions arise in the first instance. And then there's things like and dislike. Then there's things like function, what is it, what does it do, can I use it, and so on and so forth. As opposed to just seeing what it is. We do this so subconsciously. I mean, on a social level, conventional level, we need to do that. Like we name things. We say these things here, we can call these spectacles, or I'd call them glasses, but I think then you get confused with these things. But in truth, so like if you went somewhere in Africa and asked somebody for spectacles, they wouldn't necessarily know, it wouldn't mean anything. It's just a noise. In the herd, there is the herd. It's a sound, spectacle. Glass. And there is no glass. There is no spectacles. There is no kusalo. Kusalo is a conventional form, a noise that we use to identify it, and it's useful. So if you know someone says, "Oh, where's Venerable Kusalo?" You don't go off and find Philip, because that's Philip. Me Kusalo. But ultimately, where's the Kusaloness of this? My favourite is in terms of this is when I'm with my mother, I'm a son. When I'm with my son, I'm a father. And when I'm with both, I'm confused. You know, where's the son? Where's the father? And as it's Easter, we should ask about the third one. So reality, you know, in terms of the ultimate reality, things just are as they are. When a man sees a woman, or a woman sees a man, or you know, some of these gadgets. The perceptions that they create, you know, a motor car, a piece of paper with printing on it that we call money. Realities get created and believed in. And so it's like we can live in a perceptual reality rather. So whereas there is this possibility of just seeing what there is to see and hearing what there is to hear. You hear the sound, just hearing the sounds, hearing the vibration. We can, it's not like we just throw all conventional meaning out the window, but it's not to be victimized by that, to be able to have an appreciation of what it is, just as it is. I think children, you know, in the early years, before things take on substance or meaning, is this constant delight of discovering new things. You know, what's this? Oh, it's a, you know, and then and that first apprehension things, there's no good or bad, there's no value, it's new, it's fresh. And if we can come to life with that kind of an attitude. So we actually, you know, collectively, there are how many realities? The story of the, I don't know how many there were, six blind men that were describing the elephant, and one's got a hold of a trunk and say, "Oh, elephants are long and thin. That's what elephants are." And someone's got the end of the tail and saying, they're skinny and hairy. One's got a hold of the ear and it's kind of flat and leathery, so on and so forth. I mean, who's correct? Who has this reality that we call elephant? Who has the correct take? Who are we to believe? There's a corollary of that. There's six blind elephants. they're describing a human being. And the first elephant sitting down says, "Humans are flat." And the second elephant kind of reaches out its trunk and says, "Yes, I agree, humans are flat." Which just goes to show how contentious and disagreeable humans are. And so how difficult it is to, you know, like when we, just visually, when we see a person, you know, how in terms of this dependent arising, how our reality is created. People affect us very strongly in this way. So I see somebody who reminds me of, you know, somebody that I lent money and they never paid me back. Straight away, this other person reminds me of them, and I'm immediately suspicious. Intellectually, or, you know, I mean, worst case scenario, somebody who's maybe physically abused me, a relative or something, or something from childhood or something, something that's a little deeper. You know, lending money, we can get around that. But either case, somehow intellectually, we know that this person is not the same person, but emotionally, how compelled we are into that, to get reborn in relationship to that perceptual construction. So in meditation, what we're trying to open to is the truth of the way things are. So it's much simpler. I mean, our lives are much less complex in terms of contact. That whole chain of contact, feeling, perception, intention, action. That in daily life, like, you know, quote unquote normal life, that's happening a lot. The sense contact that we're experiencing and that chain of events. It's happening. It's like one of these kind of balls in the disco or in the ballroom, you know, with so many mirrors. The light is flashing off so quickly. It's difficult to have the space or the time to get behind, even if we can actually see how we are affected by these value judgments about love and hate, how we do establish ourselves in those discriminations. So on retreat, we can see these things can come up quite gently or quite slowly, one by one. You know, the example Ajahn Viridhamma gave about, you know, in the monastery around food. You know, I know I'm not going to die. I know that there's probably going to be enough. But somehow you can't help looking ahead and see what there is and see who's taking how much. And sitting down and looking at the guy's bowl next door and he got the banana that I wanted, the last one. And intellectually knowing how childish or how pathetic it is to get upset over a banana. Here I am, a grown man. But emotionally, getting caught with that. But because there is the space around that, it's because it's quite simple, and because that it's quite singular, I can actually reflect on that. I can see the intellect saying this is silly, just let it go. Followed by the emotion that kind of wants to ask for half. This is all very reasonable, of course. How could he refuse? So we get an opportunity. I mean, that's a simple example. Some of you may be experiencing more deep-seated things, but because they do arise, we can kind of take them in one by one. We can kind of set up a cue, which is another one of the questions on the use of thought. in relation to practice, skillful use of thought. We are, until we're enlightened, we have no choice. Until we realize the unconditioned, we have no choice but use the conditioned to transcend the conditioned, using karma to go beyond karma. So thought, which usually takes the form of language, you know, I find I usually think in words, not always. We can use that. We can set up a series of images or ways, strategies, ways of thinking. So for me, you know, I do things like, you know, like my present moment tour. I tend to kind of anthropomorphize or personify different aspects of my experience. It kind of helps me to objectify them a little. It's like a little mechanism or a trick. There's one an author called Douglas Adams. He was explaining how human beings can fly, and it's quite reasonable. You could try it sometime when I'm well away. The idea is you get up on a high place, like a dresser or a table or a chair on a table, or something. And the first thing is to establish confidence that it's truly faith. Faith is very important in our journey through life. We must establish faith. And so when you've reached the point, this is St. Anthony with the pilgrim, you know, this point, there is only the abyss. Jump. You have to have that confidence and jump. And just as you jump, what you need to do is to find some thing to distract you. Because the last thing you want to think about is flying. You see a kind of a tissue under the table or kind of a fly buzzing on its back on the floor or something, and you want to just hold that thought, use that thought. Because as soon as you start thinking about flying, you know what happens. You think, oh my God, I can't, I'm up, and you hit the floor. So we can use thought, just you know, like just suggestions to the mind, patience, relaxation, compassion. Those words have a meaning. They have a potency. Just the word love. Just to repeat that as a mantra, love, love. I love you. She loves me. They're like tools, and we can use those tools. The difficulty is, or the challenge is, to not be used. So we can set up a skillful structure with thought, but get lost. You know, Ajahn talks about the storyline. We get kidnapped, we get hijacked, and there we are. We're just off 1,000 miles away from our initial intention. We set up the structure of thought, and it kind of grabs us, leads us off by the nose. The structure that I work with in terms of using thought, so the four foundations of mindfulness, the classical teaching, of mindfulness of the body, feelings, mind states, or the mood. And then the fourth one is mindfulness of Dhamma. Classically, things like the Four Noble Truths, the Five Hindrances, the Three Conditions, these kind of lists. But the principle is, in terms of practice, that you using concentration to create that stillness or space, tranquility. So samadhi practice, the result is samatha, tranquility. And then using like mindfulness and clear comprehension, or clear seeing, or the stillness, or the spaciousness of the mind. We're using mindfulness, or sati, to investigate, or to observe, or to contemplate, or to reflect. We're using thought. We can use, don't have to use thought. It's possible just to introduce a theme, or a concept, or a conundrum, or a question, and just simply observe it. Like choiceless awareness. It can be more dynamic, though. It can actually, we can pose questions to that theme or that doubt or that concept or whatever it is that you're working with or that pain. And again, for me, I would tend to personify those, and I personify the pain as, say, somebody I'm having a conversation with, like a friend who's in pain. Kind of almost entering into a dialogue, or you can just put a question out there: what's the origin of this pain? And then just listen. You're kind of like holding such a question in the heart or in the guts. They're kind of both kind of emotional centres. If the pain is emotional, just putting the question kind of into that space and holding it in that space, through the stillness that comes through concentration, and then just observing it, just investigating it, just see what kind of like the light of Dhamma, if you like, that reflects off of that. So we create that the space of Dhamma, where in the seen there is the seen, in the heard there is just the heard, that kind of very open, present moment awareness type space, non-judgmental, non-discriminative, and that question is there, trying to see the truth in relation to that question. So thought can be tremendously useful. The use of language, the use of images, in the same way that we can use physical objects like shrines, icons, chanting, things like that. Like metta practice, that's basically using a whole concept structure, the idea of loving kindness, goodwill, making those suggestions repeatedly to the mind is a skillful use of language, skillful use of thought. But it needs to be kept in balance, because often what does happen is we're looking or we're in relationship with a thought or a concept, and by association it gets complicated and we get lost in the complexity of that, or we get overwhelmed, or we get sidetracked. We wake up to that, go back to concentration, re-establish the stillness or stability, just enough. It doesn't have to be kind of fourth jhana or anything like that, just enough stability so that you can, with reasonable confidence, go back to, if there's still too much energy or confusion around that, just stay with the breath or whatever, re-establishing that kind of stable, open platform on which one can then go back to the contemplation or the investigation. I'll have a look at some of these. So the question I thought was, can you please talk a little more about using thought skillfully? For example, if my mind is extremely chatty, I can note thinking for as long as it takes to develop some calmness of mind, or perhaps do some loving kindness all day if I'm being particularly hard with myself. So it doesn't sound like calmness of mind has been established, because in calmness of mind there's a relaxation. So somehow, I mean, the whole thing with thought is being able to, one, seeing that there's actually nothing wrong with thought. There's this idea, you know, that nibbana should always be pleasant, that meditation should always be silent. And just the momentum of the mind. If you have a chatty mind, you have a chatty mind. You can't make that otherwise, or you can by being hard on yourself, but that the point is not to just shut the mind up. The point is to be at peace. So the only way, really, I mean, the present moment, this idea of sankhara, the present moment exists through formations, or it has been formed, or it has been determined. there are or there were determinants. So in terms of a chatty mind, it's become a habit. That condition of the mind, it is the way it is, and in the present moment, there has to be, first of all, has to be acceptance. There has to be an allowance that this is the way my mind is at this particular. It's like if I've been busy with people, telephone, computers, and things, and I do have days like that. I've been in Toronto for 6 months, kind of city monk. And there are working nights, or working nights, you know, doing kind of dumber things. Like I got a part-time job washing dishes to keep up with the rent. But I find, you know, like going to a meeting with a group in the evening and having, you know, giving a talk and having discussion and so on and so forth, and then there's often tea and a social bit afterwards. By the time I get home, the mind's quite active, and I can't. Sometimes I can't meditate. I think, well, I'll just sit and meditate, and it's just this kind of blah blah blah. So sometimes I go for a walk or read a book, or, you know, there are different strategies. But the basic principle is creating the conditions that are not going to perpetuate. It's like starving the tiger, in effect. Feeding the tiger is perpetuating the mental restlessness through just more stimulating activity. So developing a skill or developing a relationship with the mind, this idea of participation and cooperation, you can't control, because that is being hard, and being hard is not being compassionate. But in cooperation and participation, we devise strategies to incline towards less chattiness or more silence as an inclination, not as a demand. I noticed at the beginning of the retreat, because I was quite, it's been the last few months have been quite challenging in many ways, and, well, other things as well, but I noticed the first couple of days I was just kind of bobbing up and down, and a couple of points I got really irritated with myself, this kind of gritting of my teeth. make more effort, and I just get more sleep. Just go for a walk, just give up meditating, just kind of sit, and when there's a sitting period, being able to, and that's the advantage of a retreat, that we can engage in these different experiments, you know, this kind of Zen thing, you know, when you're hungry, eat, when you're tired, sleep, chopping wood, hauling water, that kind of idea. So thought in and of itself is not such a bad thing. So, do you work with lust in the same way, processing it through the body? Lust, monastically, it's because of living a celibate life. Some people think you kind of shave your head and put on a robe and lust disappears. Still have a body, the momentum. Just on a purely physical level, that's sexuality. I mean, if we're talking about lust as sexual lust, because there is just the avariciousness for sense pleasure through physical objects, whether they be, you know, ice cream, food in general, gadgets, movies, music. Lust can arise in that way. It's interesting that the five precepts, the third precept, Kamesu, the literal translation is like sense restraint. But traditionally, because sexuality is the most potent or most difficult of in terms of sense experience, that third precept is usually talked about in terms of fidelity. It's like sexual responsibility or sexual restraint. But it is literally, it's practicing sense restraint. The way that I, because it's not suppression, any form of sense restraint, if it goes, if it's extreme, sometimes just gritting your teeth and just kind of pushing that down, you know, if you have this compulsive lust to kind of, or desire to murder somebody, I mean, don't give it any space. You know, if the compulsion is so strong, suppression's not, you know, not such a bad thing. It's not the ideal way. Anyway, lust in the body, certainly sexual lust, because it does often come through. It may begin as a mental movement, but it so often translates itself through the body. So processing it through the body is not, because focusing on the body, so often one focuses on the physical responses to the mental component. So it can get quite complicated. One of the ways that I the classic way, I guess, is contemplation of the unbeautiful, the unsatisfactory nature of the object of desire. So reflection on the impermanent nature of all things. So if it's food, just contemplating food as feces. I mean, that's what happens. It's what it is. It's grown out of the earth, the muck and manure, that kind of food. It's fuel for the body. Another way. Just observing, you know, the decomposition of, like we try produce nowadays. Food is always presented so beautifully, to the extent that it's often quite tasteless. It looks really great. But just to contemplate the way that all food, or all physical objects, they break down, they decompose, they're subject to those three conditions: impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. That none of these objects will ultimately provide true happiness or satisfaction. Another way I mean, the short answer to this is processing it through the body. I tend not to. You can experiment with that. Another way I'll work with lust is just seeing the danger that this whole process of desire and attachment, suffering, that whole cycle of events, the way that takes place. I know in my earlier monastic years in the monastery, sometimes, like, Asian families would come and there'd be the very pretty young daughter, which would always kind of catch the eye, and then the kind of grandmother would be sitting next to her. So you kind of get one of those. It's not long before you got one of those. Yeah, not to the thing. the whole practice of the contemplation of the unattractive nature of the material world, it's not to kind of set a scenario, it's all depressing and it's all just kind of, it's all rotting and it's all ugly and horrible. It's not to set up a kind of despair scenario, but it's just to see beyond the superficial, in terms of the body. We have hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. That's what is presented in the magazines, this kind of superficial beauty. And then the classic contemplation is, you know, 32 parts of the body: mucus, pus, bones, you know, bile. They never, you know, these glossy magazines, you never see. You know, those models on the cover with kind of snot running out. You just don't see. They go on in on the computer these days, and, you know, any kind of blemishes or anything, they can kind of spot them all out. and you get this kind of unreality, you know, which is what we're looking, which is what we'd like. We would like the world, we would like heaven, we would like Nibbana to be like that, completely free of blemish, completely free of taints and stains, to be always kind of beautiful and pleasant. So that the practice in relation to lust is just looking kind of behind the scenes, just looking a little bit deeper in terms of the impermanent nature of things. That it will break down, it will decompose, whatever it is. A human body or a kind of a new gadget or a new car, a new house, anything. The unsatisfactory nature of that in terms of lust. Okay, so what exactly should one do during the last moments before death comes? And the body and the mind could be in some kind of pain. The ideal is to maintain mindfulness. I mean, I'm really curious. It's kind of like the last frontier. I've had a very interesting life. You know, I haven't done everything. I haven't kind of done bungee jumping, or there's a few things that I may die never having done. But they're often, you know, those kind of worldly things. But death, I have no past life memories, no memories of death. So I'm very curious, because I do, although I don't know, I do kind of have some faith or belief in the principle of life after death. I'm really curious, you know. It's like this adventure going from here to somewhere else, some other dimension, or I mean, just don't know. And if I'm not awake, then I'll miss it. And I've done that a lot. You know, you kind of get stoned and missed it. So that clarity of mind, but what's important is to see that the last moments of death, now is the time to set that up. It's like the simile of the athlete. You know, you know in 6 months or a year, you know, you're going to be in the Olympics or whatever, and you're going to run a race. There will come that instant in time when the starting pistol goes off, and that's the point of death. That it begins that process of transition or that particular journey. You don't start training for the race, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, 5 minutes, start doing some exercise here. We're all going to die. The pistol's going to go off. And death will be there. I don't know if any of you have read Terry Pratchett. One of his characters is death. It's always written in big capital letters. Death. And whether, you know, the guy with the kind of sickle and the black cowl will be there, or quite how it will be, I have no idea. But I want to be awake. I want to be able to be present for whatever it is during that. If there, and it's likely that there will be physical pain, all the more reason to be more fit, to be more prepared. Because it is a critical time, that as a point of transition. Certainly, you know, a lot of the teaching points to that. You know, the moment of death is kind of pivotal in terms of one's rebirth. Not that, you know, one's last thought is going to determine the next birth, but I think it is quite an important time, and to be present and to be awake. But now is the time to getting ready for that. So, I mean, literally, I mean, I would think the last, if there is clarity, thoughts of love and kindness as opposed to thoughts of fear, and openness, a letting go. You know, the tendency, say, if one's loved ones are present, to be able to let them go. As an Indian gentleman was dying, kind of new immigrants, so they came with the family and set up a corner store and worked really hard and built it up into a mini mart, and he's on the deathbed and he's going around all his sons, they're named after the gods, you know, to remind him at that time of death, and Shiva's there and Krishna's there, and he's going through the sons and they're all there. He says, "Oh my God, who's minding the shop?" And he died. You have to let it go, all of it. Never mind the shop, never mind Ram and Krishna and Shiva and whatever's going to be there, or whoever's going to be there, or that's what will be there. The present moment will be the way the present moment is, always. And to have the capacity to be awake to that. So, just a bit. So, Ajahn Vee talked about God one morning. I'm not sure when this was written. Could you please elaborate on what the Buddhist take on God is, believe or non-believe? Well, I can't speak for Ajahn Viradhammo. God as a personification, personification of what? All that there is? Everything? The ultimate principle? A symbol of cosmic consciousness? The different thoughts that come to my mind. Everything that there is, you know, that you know, we, in terms of who was graceful or gracious enough to create or to give us this present moment, you know, that we created this, you know, therefore we are God. Dangerous. I wouldn't say that. Get myself into all sorts of trouble. So we can, I mean, the Buddha assiduously avoided any kind of construction. And generally the teaching, as we find it, is quite the opposite. It's deconstructing. It's kind of breaking things down. It's dissolving our perceptions of reality. Because we are so prone to want an answer. You know, show me the path. You know, there is no path. But no, show me. Ajahn, tell me, there is life after death, isn't there? Well, I don't know. No. Be nice to know. It would be nice. Because, you know, whether to pack a flashlight or... Now, if you could get some kind of advanced kind of information about the future, you know, because maybe I've got it wrong. You know, maybe... those Christians are right and I'm going to burn in hell. Now, if I knew that, if there was a God and their whole kind of package is where it's at, well, you know, it's fetch, I guess. Sorry. I don't know. I mean, I personally quite like, you know, the use of doubt as a tool. Because the present moment, what there is to be seen or what there is to be heard, is what there is to be seen and what there is to be heard. There's no doubt about this, and I allow that I may be deluded about aspects of it, but I don't truly accurately see them, so I'm not claiming to be enlightened. But the future, you know, all these kind of metaphysical questions, I like playing with the ideas. That's kind of my nature, you know, contemplating the nature of God, the nature of infinity, the essence or the nature of life or love. You know, what could these kind of principles be? You know, are they universal? Is it all the same? Is it different? No, so like philosophy, I think, in terms of the earlier question about the skillful use of thought, because it opens the mind. Two possibilities, but as soon as, or the more positional that we become, we narrow our vision. So I only see this much, but this is also to be seen, the possibility of, you know, being able to be a knower of the world. And I think with religious positions, they really limit, in the definition of the world, it limits the scope or the ability to experience the world. So that's my God, I don't know. I'm sure if he exists, she exists, be a nice guy. But all that killing, I mean, how could a loving God do that? And these are the sorts of questions that, if you create a God, how do you answer a question like that? If God is truly loving, you know, in terms of karma, it kind of, for me, it kind of makes more sense. You know, this is just the result of something. Not to even try and define, you know, why all those people got killed in a tsunami. That's just national karma, and they had it coming to them. That's too simplistic. But somehow through the law of cause and effect, and there are accidents. You know, nature just works the way nature does. And the laws of nature just, you know, function according to natural principles. You know, and our wanting to give definition or to encapsulate, you know, to explain, have that explained. And maybe with enlightenment, that all becomes apparent. I don't know. But in the meantime, I'm quite happy with doubt. What are we doing? Just maybe quickly finish this one. Question about choiceless awareness, about open choiceless awareness. When I try to make space the object of attention, it seems like the breath and pain, or breath and sound, happen together. What is supposed to happen to the breath while hearing sound, etc.? There's again, you know, what's supposed to happen, this should and ought, is quite dangerous territory. What you experience is what you experience. In principle, I think there's only one moment of consciousness. So there's hearing and there's hearing. There's seeing or there's searing. Seeing or there's seeing. It's getting late. And what we tend to do is we oscillate between the two. And it seems as if we're seeing and hearing or feeling, you know, the sound and breath and so forth happen. It's like an analogy is like the image on a computer screen. It has a kind of a homogeneous appearance to it, a substantial kind of existence, but actually it's very ephemeral. It's kind of, it has a, you know, constant refresh rate, so it's building itself, you know, so many cycles per second. It kind of rebuilds itself according to whether you clicked or pushed a button and so on and so forth, according to the information that's being, or the data that's being input. So it appears that it's kind of fluid and continuous. It's like, you know, the same with a movie. You get the individual frames as they move through quite quickly. The motion appears continuous. But in terms of consciousness, we hear, and then we see, and then we think, and then we taste. And it happens very quickly. So to actually, and it is possible to through concentration practices, to get the mind to that state where one is, where when they're in the scene, there is just the scene. One is seeing, and then one is hearing. But it's a very refined state. So what's supposed to happen is that one maintains mindfulness or awareness. It's just being awake to the way things are, and if it seems the sound and the breath are happening at the same time, that's fine. Not to say that it should be otherwise. Because we so, you know, like, it's that positional, as soon as there's a supposed to or a should, then anything else is dismissed, because that shouldn't. You know, this kind of God is like this, God is not like that. And this kind of this dualistic, positional, fundamentalist kind of approach, you know, making this distinction between love and hate, you know, setting heaven and earth infinitely apart. So a lot of, in terms of practice, the basic principle is just being awake and observing. Just looking, listening, and the intuitive mind, wisdom, same thing maybe, it's something that I feel we all have as an innate quality. We just have to allow it. If we create the space for it, then it will come. So that question, a bit like thinking and thought, contemplation, reflection, investigation of Dhamma, it's the same. It's not that it should be this way or should be that way. One just observes that, and then the light of Dhamma will kind of reflect off that in a way that we hadn't seen before, as we just look at that without any preconception. The more preconceptions we have, the less likely we are to see alternatives. Yeah. Anyway, I'll leave that. I hope that's answered your questions and been of some help.